Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am super excited to introduce my guest because I'm pretty sure I was going to Paris. I sat next to this guy who had a food truck, and I was like, oh, we should do an interview. And when I was trying to find his food truck, I found M's Ice Cream, organic ice cream company in Denver, Colorado's food truck. And so today from M's Ice Cream, here is Andrew Silverman to talk to us about organic ice cream. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. So I know it's a little bit different than what I usually talk to with my guests, but my guests are, listeners, I think we're all interested in anything that has to do with healthy living and, you know, any kind of like entrepreneurial green jobs that are, you know, that are taking care of our planet and doing, you know, and I think we also kind of like have a food thing that we like to eat healthy food and, you know, see the connection between the food that we eat and the land that we live on and how that food is grown. So I'm excited because it says M's Ice Cream is made using premium organic milk, organic cream, organic eggs, and organic cane sugar. And then one of the things that got me really excited is it says they make everything from scratch right down to their chocolate chips and their mint chocolate chip ice cream, which is my all-time favorite. So tell us a little bit about yourself first, I guess, Andrew. Are you from Denver?
I'm not. I'm actually from Maine.
Oh, cool.
So I grew up in a relatively small town in Maine where agriculture was still an important component of the local economy. And actually that's kind of what that's where my love for ice cream came from. I grew up right down the street from a dairy farm. And in the summertime, they'd make their own ice cream. They didn't make a ton of flavors, but what they did make, they made fresh almost every day. And, you know, they used their own milk and cream, and the eggs came from their chickens, and it was just phenomenal. And so that was my exposure and experience with ice cream when I was a kid, and that's what I have judged all ice cream by since.
Oh, okay. And so then how long have you been in Denver?
I've been in Denver just about 2.5 years. I was in Salt Lake for a few years in the wintertime and up in Alaska fishing in the summer. My wife got a job down here, so we made the move.
Okay. Well, then go ahead and tell us a little bit about the brainstorm behind M's Ice Cream then.
Yeah.
M is your wife. Your wife is Emily.
It is. So I was fishing. I was working on a commercial salmon fishing boat in Alaska for a few summers.
That's some dangerous work.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. It was a fantastic experience, but it is not very conducive to being married because you're gone 4, 5, nope. 6 months out of the year. And most of those fishing boats are named after wives or daughters. And so I said, well, if I can't pursue this, then I'm going to start an ice cream business and I'll name it after you. So if I can't get my boat, I'll at least have a truck that'll be named after you. So
sweet.
Yeah, so it's named after my wife, Emily. And then the real impetus was, you know, my wife and I, when we want to treat ourselves in the evening, our kind of go-to has been, let's go out and get some ice cream. There's a couple good places in Salt Lake City. There's actually one place called Hatches that does a frozen hot chocolate that is quite delicious. We used to do that. And when we got to Denver, a lot of people said, oh, there's tons of great ice cream here. And, you know, we tried pretty much everything. And I mean, it was okay. But like I mentioned earlier, you know, I had a really high bar that was set when I was a kid in Maine. So that's what everything was judged against. And I was just really disappointed. Nobody could seem to match that quality. The other thing I kind of discovered as we started to begin the business is most of the ice cream in the West is made using an American ice cream recipe, which is milk, cream, sugar, or corn syrup, some sort of sweetener, and then a binder, cornstarch, guar gum, locust gum. And it has a more icy, grainy consistency. It doesn't necessarily have the same fat content. I don't think it holds flavor as well. And what I grew up with was more of a custard style ice cream. So it's called a French on glace base, milk, cream, egg yolks, and sugar. And that's the style ice cream that we make. It has a higher fat content. I think it holds flavor much better. It has a more creamy, velvety mouthfeel. So that's the style ice cream we produce, which also sort of sets us aside from all of the other ice cream in the Denver area, at the very least, but broader than that, really.
Nice. Are you going to package it eventually then, you think?
Probably not. Wholesale is really tough. The volume that you need to do to make money and be competitive is just more of an undertaking than we're really willing to do. Also, I feel like out of necessity, the quality gets compromised a little bit just because you are producing so much ice cream. You can't. I mean, we produce small batch ice cream. Like, our maximum batch size is about 20 gallons at a time. So, like, we're really able to take time and effort, and we can be very detail-oriented with everything that we're doing. And if we were producing 2,000 gallons at a time, it would just be impossible to meet that same level of quality, I think, for our product at the very least.
They just opened a hand-churned ice cream place in Eureka last summer. That's doing pretty good. And nice. I noticed they were open most of the winter, but
yeah. Ice cream's a tough sell in the winter. So we're mobile exclusively. So we have carts and trucks, and we have lots of people who say, "Oh, you should be open in the winter. We eat ice cream in the winter." It's like, that's true, but you probably don't eat it outside. So yeah, we're seasonal. We run April through October.
Okay, So. Let's see. Tell us what flavors you make.
So right now we have we do 22 flavors. Not all of them are always available. So our trucks and carts hold between 7 and 12 flavors at any one time. So our staples that we almost always have are salted caramel, which is our most popular flavor, by usually 2-to-1, 3-to-1. And with that one, we actually make a salty caramel first and then infuse it into the base. So that's number one. One of our kind of trademark flavors is burnt brown sugar. We use a brown sugar with a high molasses content. We take that just past caramelization, brings out all the bittersweet smoky notes. That's my personal favorite. A lot of people see burnt and they're like, oh, what's that?
Okay, so burnt brown sugar.
Burnt brown sugar. So that's my personal favorite. We use a brown sugar with a high molasses content. Take it just past caramelization. Brings out all the bittersweet smoky notes. It tastes kind of like either the top of a creme brulee or a perfectly roasted marshmallow, whatever your point of reference is. And then chocolate, strawberry, vanilla. We almost always have those. Cookies and cream is one of my favorites. I was always very disappointed as a kid when there was too much vanilla or sweet cream and not enough cookies. So we negate that problem by using essentially an organic Oreo equivalent. We do a really fine grind, turn it almost to dust, and then put that in the base first so it diffuses. So every bite you get the cookie and cream flavor, and then we do big chunks of cookie on top of that. That's a really popular one. And then our mint chocolate chip, always a favorite. So we do make our own chocolate chips. We use Dagoba chocolate. They're a chocolate company out of Oregon. We use a 69% dark chocolate, melt it down, add a little bit of canola oil, which changes the melting temperature, so they stay malleable even when frozen, so you don't get that kind of Yeah, so you don't get that chalky sensation. The chips stay malleable, and you can actually taste the chocolate. And it is white; it's not green. So sometimes some kids who haven't experienced the white mint chocolate chip, you hand it to them, and they kind of give you this quizzical look because they're like, "Hold on, this is supposed to be green. What's going on here?" But once they taste it, they know.
Yeah, And that's the best kind, the white kind, I think.
It is. Well, it's always funny when adults are like, why isn't it green? I say, well, why would it be green? They're like, the mint. It's like, that's not how that works. Like, that green is a color additive exclusively. It does not have a flavor.
Okay. Is that 12? I'm not counting.
Okay. No. And then, so some of our seasonal flavors, we do a pumpkin in the fall. We do a cinnamon ice cream in the fall. We're in Colorado, so Western Slope Palisade peaches are amazing. So that's a very popular one. And we only usually do one big batch of that, usually the second or third week of August, and it goes very fast. So that's a fun one to look out for. A new flavor for us this year, we did a balsamic fig compote that we swirl through sweet cream. That's very good. Some of the other flavors, we do a ginger, which was my favorite growing up. We use raw ginger. We blanch it first, which takes out a lot of the bitterness, and then we steep that in the base, so you get all kind of like the sweet notes of the ginger. We've done an Earl Grey in the past. What else? We've done a strawberry balsamic on occasion.
For some reason, my computer quit recording my voice right here. So I'm just going to keep Andrew's answers as best I can with what he says. And you're going to just have to figure out what I was saying, I guess, for a little bit. Then I come back on.
A lot of it is kind of my experience with other ice cream I've had in the past. Some flavors are ideas that I had, and then someone did it better somewhere, and I was like, oh, that's fantastic. And then, you know, we've tried to improve upon that. But, you know, something I will say we do stay away from, we don't do, like, crazy novelty flavors. Like, we don't do, like, sriracha lime or anything like that. Just because, you know, I kind of feel like ice cream is, you know, it's a novelty flavor is fun, but it's nothing that you go back for again and again. I mean, and we're really trying to build a business here that's going to, you know, last a long time. So we try to focus on the flavors that have universal appeal and or those that, you know, have a classic base but are slightly modified to more modern palates. So we try to, you know, cover all our bases. Yeah, well, I would begin by saying if you're familiar with the expression that a boat is a hole in the ocean that you throw money into, the same could be said about a food truck. Trucks are extremely expensive both to build and maintain. It's not an easy business by any means. We actually started with carts, little ice cream carts. They were a lot less expensive to purchase, and it kind of allowed us to do proof of concept first before we went out and invested in one truck and then two trucks. The other thing I will say is, you know, we are scooping ice cream, so really the singular piece of equipment we have in a food truck is a cold plate freezer. That's it. And you know, it is pretty much self-contained. Cold plate freezers are actually pretty amazing pieces of technology. They are lined with heavy insulation. They have cold plates inside of the insulation, so you plug them in, they freeze overnight, and then they'll hold 0 degrees for 12 hours with a 90 degree ambient temperature. So our trucks are extremely simple in comparison to someone that's trying to do a full food truck build out with fryers and griddles and stovetop cookers and heat tables and cooling racks and all that stuff. So we are probably not the best example by which to judge how a food truck works. But yeah, trucks are a lot of work. You gotta keep them busy. That's the most important part. It doesn't matter how nice your truck is or how great your food is. If you're not working every day, the trucks have to be busy. No. Yeah. So that's not, yeah. So we do actually, farmers markets turned out not to be a great fit for us. Partially because most of them are early in the morning, relatively early in the morning, and ice cream is not it's a hard sell. Pre-breakfast ice cream is really hard sell. And then we don't drive around playing music because that's not – typically all of those trucks are selling a packaged product, and we're all hard scoop dip ice cream. And so our setup is a little bit more involved. So, you know, we'd have to stop and get out cones and – dip ice. So yeah, so we go to a lot of, excuse me, we do a lot of arts festivals, we do a lot of movie nights, outdoor concerts, outdoor movies, outdoor theater events. We do a lot of school events throughout the year or throughout the summer. No, like end of school graduations, like spring events, back to school, like fall things. Yeah, so we do, you know, our focus is really on kind of like family-friendly community-type activities. That's where we have done the best. So, and then in Denver, there are a couple of weekly scheduled food truck events where, you know, it'll be between 10 and 20 of the local trucks that all come together. There's one we do downtown Denver called Civic Center Eats. It's held every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and it's a rotating group of trucks that meets in Civic Center Park, which is right across from the State House. And that's a big draw for everyone that works downtown and for tourists as well. So, yeah, so we actually used to make our own base in-house, and then we just got to the point that we couldn't do it. The economics weren't working anymore. It was too big and it was too time intensive. So we found a dairy out of California, Northern California. And so they now make our recipe. So they do the whole thing. So the milk, the cream, the egg yolks, the sugar. So all that is being produced by them now. So that's a California product. And, you know, they're fourth generation farm, like great business, really happy to support them. Our strawberries come out of the Western Slope Palisade. Some of our other fruit, we've done a blueberry, pumpkin, some of those are not coming out of Colorado, but they're being produced here. So some of the fruit flavors, we use a jam from Colorado Mountain Jam, great company, Western Slope. They've been around for a long time. They were just able to, they have much better relationships with farms, and they were able to get better product than we would. So just for consistency's sake, we started going through them.
I'm pretty sure I asked him here, what's the Western Slope?
Well, so the Rockies, Colorado, the Rockies divide the western half of the continent. So Denver is Eastern Slope. And you go up and over the Rockies and then Western Slope. So that's kind of how Colorado, usually when people are talking about areas in Colorado, it's Eastern Slope, Western Slope. So Grand Junction, Palisade, that's all Western Slope, borders Utah. Eastern Slope or the Front Range is, you know, Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins, Colorado Springs. So the Rockies are used as the dividing line. Hi, Jackie.
Hey, Andrew. Okay. All right. Well, I don't know. I'll try to fix that. I guess it was recording you and not me.
Oh, no.
I can hopefully go back through and just patch it in. Okay. So where were we? So you were talking about the Western Slope and the Eastern Slope, and then... So what else do you want to tell listeners about?
Support local business.
Okay.
Support small business. I think that's important. I do think that, you know, there's a benefit not just to the business holder, but also to yourself. I think that, you know, if someone is from the community and they have a business that exists in the community, they really put forth a high degree of effort to make sure that they're creating a product or providing a service that not only benefits the community, but is exceptional, because they know that they will be judged upon that. And therefore they really, you know, a lot of work and effort goes into it. Whereas that may not be the case if it's a, you know, a big chain brand that, you know, you're just one of many. So, yeah.
So how many people, like, do you run both food trucks? Is it you and your wife, or do you have helpers, or how does that work?
Yeah, no. So my wife is actually a professor at the medical school here in Denver. So she is the namesake, but she is not involved in the business really on a day-to-day basis. So I have two full-time kitchen people that manage all of the production. And I'm in the kitchen fairly regularly as well, kind of just doing quality control and doing some – oh, hold on. Sorry. Tea kettle's going off.
That's fine.
2 seconds.
No worries.
Fair. We're significantly more sizable than we have been our first season.
15 people that work on the trucks?
Yeah, carts.
Wow. Is that because, like, I don't know, it takes like 3 people at a time and just to rotate schedules or something? Like, wow, that's a lot of people.
So, well, we have 2 trucks, 3 carts in this. So starting really next week, 1st of June, everything's running simultaneously. We run events 7 days a week, usually 2 to 3 events during the week and 4 to 5, sometimes even 6 events on the weekend. So we kind of need a fairly significant staff to cover all of that. Usually the carts, at big events, we'll have 2 people working the carts. Big events for the trucks, we'll have 3 people. But some of the smaller things, one person's able to manage.
Okay. So how about, so you started out with just a couple of carts. And
yes.
So then where were you making the ice? Do you, I guess you don't make the ice cream in the truck. You must make it, like, do you have a factory or something?
No, we have a commissary space, and a commissary is essentially just a shared kitchen space. We have a really good one. They come in a variety of of sizes and styles. We got into one that was really, really nice. It had just been built. It's also somewhat unique in that a lot of commissaries, it's essentially just a big open communal kitchen. The commissary we work out of is private kitchen spaces. So you are booked certain allotted times in certain kitchens, and you're there exclusively as your own business. It's not a shared facility when you are there. So that's nice, especially because we are certified organic. It would be really hard to kind of overlap with another business, especially if they were, you know, doing meat or something non-organic. That would not be an ideal pairing. So we have a really good setup right now.
I'm confused. So it's a shared space, but you mean it's not shared the day you're there? Like, when the day you're there, it's all you or something? Or like the hours that you're assigned?
Yeah. So the hours that we're there during our allotted shift. So they work in 8-hour increments. Uh-huh. So for our 8-hour shift, we are there by ourselves. It's all us.
And then what do you have a freezer space where you store your food and a pantry shelf or something? I mean, you just don't have to bring your food every time, do you?
So this place is equipped actually with massive refrigerator and freezer capacity. So we're able to store all of our product there. And then as soon as the ice cream is made and frozen, we move it offsite to a cold storage facility. So, because we produce a lot of ice cream and they just don't have the capacity to hold it all.
Okay. And so then the people that work with you, like, you all meet at the cold storage facility and load up your carts and trucks the day of your event, or how does that work?
Yep, that's it. We basically, you know, we'll usually try to prep the day before, just because a lot of the events start pretty early in the morning. So, you know, if we're prepping for Saturday, we'll meet early Friday morning, stock up all the carts and trucks to make sure we've got a good mix of flavors and enough product to cover the potential demand of the event. And then, yeah, Saturday morning, head on out to the event, and hopefully it's good weather, good turnout, and we'll have a good day. And then,
now how do you transport a cart?
Carts live on the back of a truck on a trailer. So I did not have a lot of trailer experience prior to starting this business. So that was a pretty steep learning curve, learning to back up a giant enclosed trailer.
Okay. I'll bet you can get it into any kind of little tiny parking spot now, huh?
I'm pretty good. Not to toot my own horn, but I have definitely, I think, developed some pretty impressive trailer skills out of necessity.
Okay. Let's see. What else might listeners be wondering about? So, we talked about different flavors. So do you have like any kind of a testing process? Like, do you survey your customers? Like, how do you know or do you just go by sales, I guess, maybe what they buy and what, like, do you have a method for that?
So it's a great question. Actually, in the beginning, I put together a list of, I think, 70 different flavors. Just by name alone, because I mean, ultimately sampling is a big component of our business, but people are only going to sample flavors that they're interested in. So I put together a list of 70 flavors. I sent it out to people, did a big survey, came back, and then we produced, I think out of that list, we produced 12. And then the other 8 were flavors I really wanted to produce because I thought they would be amazing and we would do them really well. Going forward, we do get some feedback. We've been asked to produce a butter pecan, which we're working on. We're hoping to have that done for later in the summer. Some nut flavors we've been asked for, either a pistachio or like a roasted almond chocolate flavor. It would be a good one. The only concern for us is we encounter a lot of people that have pretty severe nut allergies, kids especially.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of concern about, you know, if there's any sort of nut in either the ice cream or in, because I mean, in severe,
even in the processing facility,
yeah, in severe cases, it's, you know, even if it's used in a production run, there can be some adverse effects. So for that reason, we've actually we've really kind of stayed away from any nut flavored ice cream or nut inclusion ice cream, just to make it safe for everybody.
What about, like, you know, I know you're selling ice cream, but, like, is there any, like, health benefits or, like, calorie things, like, people might be thinking about or wondering about with your ice cream that's different than, like, regular ice cream? And, like, one of my friends pointed out, most ice cream you get in the store anymore isn't even, like, actually ice cream. They call it, like, an ice-flavored product.
Oh, yeah, ice milk or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, our ice cream is amazing and delicious, but it is not a low calorie food by any means. I will say that our products, like, we've done some sort of carnival type events where it's, you know, funnel cakes and fried turkey leg and horse and stuff like that. Yep. And it's always funny because I half joke with people that, you know, we probably have the healthiest food option here. And I think that often is the case. Our ice cream is made exclusively out of milk, creams, egg yolks, and sugar. So, you know, if consumed in moderation, none of those things are bad for you. It's a really simple, clean product. And I will say my wife ran Division I track in college, and her coach did say that ice cream is a fantastic recovery food. So, you know,
nice.
There's a health benefit for you.
I'll say. What about the cones?
The cones. So in a perfect world, we would produce our own cones, but we have just such limited space in the truck and carts that that's not really an option. So we use Joy cones. It's, you know, they've used the same recipe for 60 years. It's the cone you grew up with as a kid. And we have cake cones and sugar cones. That's it. So the classic options are there.
That's what I like. I like the sugar cones anyway. And yeah. I like wrote this little book about, it's called The Green Queen. And she goes around and like, it's the Green Queen might seem really mean. And she might even scream if she sees you like, you know, throwing a can in the garbage or not recycling or doing things. And like, one of her things is she tells people, don't get a styrofoam bowl, get a cone and throw the cone in the garbage if you don't want to eat it. But just, you know, something that's going to biodegrade.
It's true.
What made me think of that, but I always think you should don't get a cup, get a cone.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And we are so as of in let's see. So our spoons, sampling spoons, and regular spoons are both made out of wood. So those are 100% compostable. Our napkins are made from 100% recycled material, so those are all recyclable, compostable. And our new cups, we've had a hard time sourcing a good cup that was both biodegradable, compostable, but also the right size. But we just found one, so we're moving over to that. So we will have a very light footprint as a result of it.
Nice.
Yeah.
I was just going to say something.
Do you think people would have any interest in like the certification process?
Yeah.
All right. So our organic certifier is CCOF. They are out of Santa Cruz, California.
Slow error. Okay. It's back on.
Okay. So our organic certifier is CCOF. They're out of Santa Cruz, California. We've had a really positive experience working with them. You know, going into this, I didn't know anything about what was required to become a USDA certified company, and they were extremely helpful in kind of providing me with all the documentation and guidance that was needed. Really patient, thoughtful, kind folks over there. And yeah, it is an extensive process. It takes quite a bit of time and it's very detail oriented. But you know, it's also, you learn a lot about what it takes to become organically certified, obviously. But I think you also develop a real appreciation for what that logo carries. I mean, it's pretty ubiquitous these days and you see it everywhere, but you know that once you've completed the process and you see it, you're like, this is, you know, this actually means something. It's not just a fancy slogan. It is
significant. Give us just like a couple of like basics of like, you absolutely have to do this, or you, something you were surprised about, or you can't, you know, this is like one major component of getting certified. Like, what's the first step or something?
So the first step is really to determine if you can even make an organic product. There were some flavors that we wanted to make. There's a Mexican vanilla that is really delicious that we wanted to produce our vanilla ice cream, that we couldn't get, organically. And, you know, that was a surprise to me because there just wasn't an organic equivalent. Sometimes they'll make there are compromises. There are a few foodstuffs out there where if there isn't an organic substitute, you're able to use that product. But with the vanilla, for instance, there are some really good organic vanillas. And so the initial vanilla we wanted to use was not an approved one. So that was a surprise right off the bat. So, you know, it made us really kind of go back, because we had initially developed a flavor list of, okay, this is what we're going to create. And then, you know, we had to go and look at every single ingredient and find out if we could, one, get the quality ingredient that we wanted in an organic format. And then two, if we couldn't, could we substitute it with something and still be satisfied? So, you know, it did take a little bit of reinvention of what we had initially envisioned.
So were there added problems to being fiscally solvent with an organic? Like, is it costing you more? And do you find people are willing to pay more for an organic product? Like, how about that part of it?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. Yes, it costs significantly more. If we were to use conventional milk or even a conventional ice cream base, it would cost half of what we pay. So that's significant. You know, we have to stay competitive in our market, so we can't charge too much more. We are definitely slightly more expensive than every other ice cream company in Denver. Usually that hasn't been an issue. I think, you know, we definitely have a giant USDA logo on the side of our truck, and we're very happy to promote the fact that we are organic. Rarely do we encounter a price objection, and when we do, we kind of share the narrative about what makes us special and the fact that we are organic and everything's made from scratch. And most often that negates any sort of price issue.
Okay. All right. Anything else you wanted to say about the organic process? I sorry, kind of interrupted you there. So the first step was to figure out what you were going to make, and then.
Yep.
Do they come inspect you, or they just inspect your recipes, or?
No. So the way the inspection works is they come and look at your facility, and then they basically pull a product off a shelf and say, kind of like, essentially, prove this is organic. Like, we want to see, and there's an extensive amount of documentation involved. So for us, every single tub of ice cream is labeled with the production date, the batch number, and the flavor. And that's all tracked back right to the ingredients that's used in that particular bucket. So you do need to be quite detail oriented to maintain the organic cert standard.
And then do you have to pay them to come inspect you?
You do. So there's an initial application fee and inspection fee. And then after that, after the first year, there is a renewal and re-inspection fee. Through the federal government, there has been an organic reimbursement where I think they'll reimburse you up to I think it's like up to 75% on the first $1,000 for being an organic food producer.
Cool.
Yeah.
So in Montana, speaking of government and things like that, they came up with a new cottage foods law where you could sell foods. And there's like all sorts of regulations about having like a mobile truck and stuff like that. Do you have to deal with that in Colorado? Like, separate regulations for just being a food truck moving around?
Yep. So in Colorado, Denver County, although it is the seat of the state capital, does not recognize the state's mobile requirements and vice versa, although they're identical. So we do have redundant licensing. So we are licensed for the city of Denver, which allows us to sell and operate trucks throughout the entire county of Denver. And we're also licensed through Jefferson County, which allows us to vend through the trucks and carts throughout the rest of the state. So there is a significant amount of licensing required.
Like that. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, have I missed anything?
I think that's pretty thorough.
I think so too. Ready for my final question I ask everybody?
Okay.
If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, Andrew, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Whoa.
I know.
That's a big finishing question. Because we are a food-based business, I will speak specifically to that. I think that we really need to be conscious in terms of creating and maintaining a food system that's sustainable. I think without that, obviously we're up a creek. So I would like to see more time and effort being spent on making sure that our food systems across the board are all done in a fair, sustainable, and equitable manner.
Cool. Okay. Do you want to tell listeners how to find your website and if they're in the Denver area, how to find your food truck and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is emsicecream.com, so EMSicecream.com. Our fixed locations in the summertime are on the 16th Street Mall between Curtis and Champa. We're also up at Red Rocks Amphitheater for most of the shows and concerts this summer. Otherwise, on social media, we post our locations almost daily. So you can find us at M's Ice Cream on Facebook or Twitter, Instagram as well.
Do you just want to say something really? I have never had the pleasure of going to Red Rocks, but I have heard about it forever. If listeners have not heard about the Red Rocks Amphitheater, can you tell them a little bit about it?
Yeah. So I believe Red Rocks was first used as a performance space in the 1920s. It's essentially just a natural amphitheater that's carved out of the sandstone up in the foothills of Denver. It's a beautiful space. I think
outdoors,
totally outdoors, open under the sky. It draws really, really good music, wide variety of musical, types. So over the course of the summer, you'll have everything from, I think actually last night was the Flaming Lips with the Colorado Symphony. There was a death metal band earlier this weekend. And then there's an electronic or earlier this week. And then there's an electronic group, this weekend. So, they also have movies there. It's called Film on the Rocks. So amazing performance space. Worth checking out if you ever have the opportunity. Otherwise, Red Rocks is actually owned by the city of Denver. It is a park as well. So during the day when there isn't a performance happening, you're more than welcome to go up there and just explore the area. You can, you know, go down into the amphitheater. Actually, a lot of people use it for as an exercise space. There's a lot of exercise programs up there. So
are there actual seats or do like people sit on the rocks?
Nope. So there are seats now. And obviously when it first opened, that wasn't the case. It was just, you know, the natural rock form. But now there are, like kind of bench seats that run up the length of the amphitheater.
Cool. Yeah. What was the best concert you ever saw there?
To be honest, I've never seen a concert at Red Rocks.
Really? How long have you been in Denver?
2.5 years.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So,
yeah.
Summer. So, yeah, we actually just got the contract to bend up at Red Rocks during the performance shows. I've been up there quite a few times, like hiking around, because there's some awesome hiking and biking trails right in the park. But, yeah, I haven't had the pleasure of seeing a show. So, looking forward to that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew, and thanks for putting up with my technology problems. And I just hope this is all going to work out. And I'm seeing lots of good sound waves, so I think we're in business.
Awesome.
Okay. You have a great day.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you. And I'll send you the link when it comes out.
Okay, cool. Looking forward to it.
Okay.
How many subscribers do you have?
I have somewhere between like 1,000 and 1,500.
Cool.
I'm just little growing, but that's a pretty good audience. I've been doing this for about a year.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I'd say that's real good after a year.
Yeah. They say most podcasts only get like 200 downloads after 6 weeks. And like I said, mine get between 800 and 1400, somewhere in there after 6 weeks. So
cool.
Yeah. And it's just growing. I haven't had a lot of time to promote it. I've barely been having time to put it out lately.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I just been, I don't know, my work schedule kind of comes and goes. And so when you have work in Montana, you got to do it. So,
yeah. So what do you do, Jackie?
Well, I was an elementary school teacher and then I kind of quit to focus on my online business. And then the podcast actually is like, you know how some people say you should focus and don't polish those shiny pennies? The podcast is kind of my shiny penny. And like, because I want to be an artist. Like my dream is to be a children's book artist, illustrator. But I love biography. So it works really well because it's like doing a mini biography every day.
Oh, cool.
And I thought my husband would do the podcast because he's the gardener and he would just teach people. And then, I don't know, after I joined this podcasting group, I was like, well, hey, these people are interviewing people. I can interview people. And I don't know, I just started and it's been going well. And I don't know, I love my guests. I think you guys are all super inspirational. I love to hear about these green businesses and different things people are doing. I don't know why, like at this time of my life, I'm like obsessed with business, like podcasts and just learning about business, maybe because I just want to have my own business, like successfully, like, cause I've tried to have a business for years, sort of like on and off and on and off and have never been very successful. So
Yeah.
I like learning the new tips. So this is where, because like I've been trying to grow an online business and like sell my artwork since 2010. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started my podcast in 2015 that I even got hits on my website or people like listening. And some of that's probably consistency with my podcast. I generally put out 2 episodes a week. I've been putting out, there's only 1 month where I didn't have 8 episodes, and that was February because I was teaching full time. Yeah. So.
Do you ever listen to, do you know Gimlet Media?
Yeah.
Yeah.
With like the startup.
Yeah.
And, well, and Serial is sort of, well, that's from This American Life, but I think they were, but yeah, the startup show. And then what's the new one? Dating Ring and Mystery Show.
Mystery Show. And
I like her. What's her name?
Reply Starly. All.
What is it?
Reply All is another one.
No. Oh, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I really like Startup and Reply All are my two favorites. You know, Serial, I don't know. I don't like it as much as I thought I would.
Well, the second season isn't anywhere near as good as the first season.
Yeah,
I don't know.
The stories, they start really interesting and then they kind of flame out. I don't know. But I love This American Life. And Radiolab, do you ever listen to that one?
A little bit.
Yeah?
Yep. And I have not, you know what? I don't know why. I have never listened to This American Life. I should download that right now. This is Jackie Marie Beyer, and I am just hoping that you're as excited to be learning and gardening this spring as I am. And so I'm really wondering what you're up to this spring. And I'm super excited to announce that I am finally going to launch my Facebook group, the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook group. So I really want to hear about your journey, and I really hope that you will come there and share your questions, your successes, your challenges, your pictures, your, you know, connect with the other listeners in the audience and, you know, what's your vision for the future, or what's your vision for your garden, for your organic oasis? You know, are you planting flowers? What are you doing? You know, what project are you taking on this spring, this summer? You know, I really want to learn, you know, what do you want to know? Is there, you know, what kind of guests do you like? You know, who have you enjoyed? Who would you like to hear more of? You know, what topics are you really enjoying? You know, is it raising honeybees or planting perennials, or, you know, what kind of seeds are you looking for? You know, are they annuals, perennials? You know, what kind of vegetables, what kind of herbs are you planting? What flowers? Do you have any questions that we can answer? You know, what guests have you liked the most? You know, so what is there something you want me to find out? Like, I'm really going to try to be as active in Facebook, the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook page and the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook group. So, you know, if you're interested in, you know, learning more and reaching out and connecting with other people, you know, especially, you know, the great thing about it is all of a sudden, you know, you might meet 3 people who are in your area. Just like since I started my podcast, you know, I met Robin Kelson and Laura Behenna. So it was so fun to see them last week. And Pamela Lund, who, if you haven't heard her episode, she's just got a great story. You know, well, Robin's been in the top 10 since she aired. But to meet these, you know, people, and then I went to the Aero Conference and met more people that are living locally near me here in Montana that I never knew till I started my podcast. And so if you join the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook group, you'll probably meet people in your area. And then maybe I'll be able to find some people from the other states, because I think I'm up to like state 20 or 21 still. So there's still more states that I haven't interviewed people from than states that I have. One of these days I'm going to read that list and try to get some people, some listeners. Listeners always make great guests, I think. You've all got more knowledge than you think to share and some answer that somebody else has been looking for. So if you want to come on and share your gardening journey, you know, I'm always looking. But today I really want to talk about, you know, join our group. You know, let me know, what can I do for you? Even if you don't want to do the Facebook thing, I totally understand. Or if you have another channel that you like, you know, reach out to me, email me, go to the website. You know, you can connect with me. There's the Get in Touch page. There's a listener survey on there where you can, you know, which basically is just easy questions about, you know, what's your biggest challenge that I can help you with. But just most of all, I hope if you want to, you will come join the Facebook group, connect with me, and just let's change the world together. Thanks for listening, and remember to